This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, how abortion became the hot-button political issue in America. Then, why criminology experts believe a lot more hate crimes are happening than FBI data would suggest. Also, what happens in your brain when a too catchy tune gets stuck there? That's coming up on Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. The Biden administration is suing to stop Texas from implementing a new law that bans all abortion after a fetal heartbeat is detectable, which is around 6 weeks of pregnancy. That is a stricter standard than the U.S. Supreme Court established as the minimum constitutional right in Roe v. Wade. And so, once again, the issue of abortion is front and center in the talking points and the campaign fundraising emails of politicians all across the political spectrum. Why is abortion such an emotional and important issue in American politics? Even more so, I'd argue, than the death penalty or gun control, and certainly more so than tax policies, which affect every single one of us every single day. I'm joined in studio by Top of Mind regular contributors Chris Karpowitz and Grant Madsen. Chris is a professor of political science, Grant a professor of history, both at Brigham Young University. Welcome to both of you. It's good to see you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It is great to be here.
What do you think about my assertion that abortion is kind of in its own category when it comes to American political issues?
Public opinion on abortion is unique, and it seems to be somewhat different than the rhetoric, the often overheated rhetoric about this issue, in the sense that most Americans are roughly in the middle on this issue. And what I mean by that is most Americans, 6 in 10, really do not want to see Roe versus Wade overturned. On the other hand, most Americans also do not want to see abortion on demand and are perfectly comfortable with limits that go beyond what Roe versus Wade and the subsequent cases would guarantee. There are, I would say, important partisan differences, right? If you ask people, should abortion be available most or all of the time, most Democrats agree with that. And if you ask, should abortion be available some or none of the time, most Republicans would agree with that. But there's a lot of room there in terms of the some and most categories versus the all and never categories.
So what's the history here, Grant, that would help us understand when and why did it become like a litmus test for, you know, if you're going to be nominated to the Supreme Court, we have to know where you stand on abortion. And if you're, you know, and even if you're a politician, you're going to get asked in a lot of cases, if you're running for Congress or Senate or president, where do you stand on abortion?
So the short answer as to when this became a litmus test for the Supreme Court would have to be something like the 1980s, right? So Roe v. Wade came down in the early 70s. But the longer answer to speak to, you know, kind of add to what Chris has said, most really controversial cases over time become less controversial. So at the time that, say, for example, Brown v. Board of Education came down from the court, that was the order to desegregate public schools. You know, at the time it was controversial. I mean, even required President Eisenhower to send in the National Guard in order to enforce it. But it's not very controversial now, right? Like, I mean, we have kind of built a consensus around the idea that, you know, we should not segregate based on race in a whole variety of aspects of American life. So that's not a controversial issue anymore. What's interesting about Roe v. Wade, and to your point, how you started this is, we've had now 50 years to live with Roe v. Wade, the case where it constitutionalized abortion. And we still – like what Chris told us, I mean what he said would have been true, I think, of polling back in the 70s. I mean, is that roughly right? I'm looking over at Chris to – you know, in other words, it's been this way for so long. And so it's not just controversial. It's a controversy that just won't go away. And I think that's why you're asking the question the way you are, is I don't think you're wrong. I think that it is still something we can't quite make sense of. And the real issue, the core fundamental problem, is that it pits two things that are – you know, fundamental American notions of freedom and rights. You know, and the catchphrases both sides use are exactly on point. Is it, you know, Does the government have a compelling interest to protect life? So for anti-abortion advocates, they'd say, no, you're protecting human life. And then alternatively, you have this very old American notion, you know, that comes even in some ways out of our experience with slavery and so on, that we have an inviolable right to our bodies, right? That no government can tell us or force our, you know, in our bodies to decide what we do with our bodies, right? And so and these are, at least in the question on the question of abortion, these are incommensurate. There's no compromise.
And that, yeah, I think this is such an important point, Grant, because it also highlights the limits of the language of rights.
Yes, right.
And when you get a controversy like this, where two deeply held rights are at stake, the court is not usually the best vehicle for finding the compromise solution. Jamal Green has been writing a lot about this lately. He's a legal scholar who says, well, there are sort of limits to the court's ability to resolve these things and when sort of deeply held rights are at stake like this. And what we really need are political solutions that allow us to find compromise in different ways. Compromises that might reflect a little more where public opinion is on this issue, the sort of nuanced compromises or nuanced balances that public opinion broadly conceived seems to be pointing toward. But that's really hard for the court to do. The court has to declare a winner and a loser. No matter what the decision is, activists on the other side will feel frustrated with it and will want to continue the debate. And again, that I think highlights the limits of the Supreme Court's ability to give us policy solutions in realms like this.
So but are the two of you arguing then that abortion would not be such a heated political debate today if it had been settled by Congress? Instead of by a Supreme Court ruling in 1970s.
I would not say that the issue would go away,
right.
But the nature of the debates might be a little different.
How so?
In the sense that we could try out these different sorts of compromises and we would have some practice at trying to bring the two sides together, which is a really hard thing to do when both sides think, well, let's just get it to the court and they'll give us everything that we want on one side or the other.
So it would make the nomination process for Supreme Court justices probably easier.
Certainly would help.
Because abortion, because where do you stand on Roe versus Wade would not be
exactly.
The first question out of the gate.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. But we wouldn't have this sort of weird theater where they say they haven't made a decision or thought about it when most intelligent law professors have done so.
But I'm so fascinated
legal scholars.
I'm so fascinated by the idea, though, that if state legislatures, because that's what we had before Roe versus Wade,
right.
States enacting their own laws. I mean, that's how we ended up with Roe versus Wade, right? With a lawsuit against a state. Was it Texas?
Okay. Texas. It's always Texas.
So, you know, if it hadn't made it to the Supreme Court and it had just been a matter of states enacting, I mean, I don't entirely see how that would have led us to a different place today.
It may not have, but I think what Chris is trying to say is that institutionally there are some advantages, right? So courts, when courts step in, they take things out of the political process, and that's by design. But sometimes things belong in the political process.
Because it went to the court, that's also why we get these two kind of intractable – it's the language of rights.
So sometimes
it's the right to my body or my personal choices.
And that's really what I'm talking about, Julie, is that language sometimes makes it hard to find policy solutions that both sides might be able to live with. Now, I'm not saying there would never be controversy.
No, I think you would probably –
likely have if Roe versus Wade is overturned and it's really left to the states, what you're going to have is a patchwork of very different approaches. And you'll have more liberal states taking one approach and more conservative states taking another approach. But I guess the other point I would make is that prior to 1973, abortion wasn't the issue that hung over American politics in almost every way. And yet it is today. It's one of the defining issues.
How did the Republican Party become the party, the anti-abortion party, and
this
the Democrats?
This is a good question because it wasn't always that way.
Right.
In fact, earlier the Republican Party was, if anything, was a more pro-choice party.
Really?
Yeah.
In
a very general sense, and I'm going to use a political science term here, so Chris will have to tell me if I'm using it correctly, but we'd call this part of the realignment of the 1970s.
Okay.
So the moment at which the Republican Party stopped being a kind of, I don't know, I'm maybe being a little unfair, but sort of a Northeastern country club party. Of basically sort of quasi-aristocratic Americans and became essentially the home for evangelical Christians. And it worked in both ways. Evangelicals became more Republican. Republicans became more evangelical. Through the 1970s, that process was sort of going on in some ways kind
intentional.
Of—
Intentional. So this was part of an intentional effort to, on
some
the part
people's
of
parts, but,
Republican presidential candidates?
I would say in the 70s, not a lot of – I would say it happened below the radar.
Okay.
It's one of these things we sort of know of after the fact. Mm. But the famous moment is when Ronald Reagan as a candidate went to a giant conference of evangelicals and said, the conference had said we cannot endorse a candidate. And so he said, I know you cannot endorse me, but I endorse you.
Mm.
And it's sort of this very famous moment where essentially the Republican Party understood, oh, this is our future, and so did evangelicals. Right?
Well, and this is such an important point because when we look at the public opinion, evangelicals are very different from every other religious group on this particular issue, on the issue of abortion. They are the group that overwhelmingly opposes abortion. And so as the Republican Party becomes the party of evangelicals, the other thing that's happening, and this starts a little earlier, it starts in the 1960s with Richard Nixon, is that the southern states are moving from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party. And that revolves to some extent around issues of race as the Democratic Party becomes the party of civil rights.
Mm.
But it also intersects with these sort of religious realignments as well. And so what you have is one party that is the party of evangelicals, and evangelicals have a very distinctive view about abortion. It is quite distinct from the opinion of Catholics or other religious groups on this issue, who all tend to lean in the other direction. And so when you have those partisan realignments overlapping or lining up with religious distinctions, then that's an added element that makes this issue seem even more important because now we've got partisan and religious differences at work on this issue of abortion.
The commitments run deep.
They really do.
And okay, so this happens with Reagan.
That's when it really takes off. Yeah.
Okay, are white evangelicals? I guess, Chris, this is a question for you. Still so important to the Republican Party today that the Republican Party – that abortion as strict as the law passed in Texas, for example, is the kind of thing that that the Republican Party just, as a party automatically nods and says, yes, that is exactly what we need to be doing.
I think many Republicans want to limit – the number of abortions that are performed in the United States, think that it should be rare or never, and they are perfectly happy with additional restrictions of some sort. But the law in Texas is unique, and it has some unique features that even makes even some Republicans a little bit uncomfortable.
And is that because it doesn't allow even exceptions in case of the mother's?
It's more because of the
health.
Way this is enforced. So
okay.
The Texas law doesn't actually give the state the right to enforce it. It gives individual citizens the right to sue abortion providers and to recoup large damages and other court costs more easily. That particular approach could be applied to many different constitutional rights. You could have more liberal states, for example, passing similar laws that say, okay, well, the state isn't going to enforce this, but individuals can sue gun owners or gun stores, gun manufacturers, and take them to court and have a kind of limiting effect on the Second Amendment. And that is the concern, I think, that people might have. People of both parties, regardless of your view of abortion, might have about the specific Texas case. There are other states who have passed different kinds of laws that I think don't run into that particular problem. The worry that people would have is if there are constitutional rights at stake, it's typically the national and state governments have a stake in enforcing and protecting those rights. And what the Texas law does is sort of take the state out of it and say, well, no, we're just going to sort of leave this to individuals and to individual activists to sue.
So circling back then, I guess, just to kind of wrap this up, If the solid conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court decides, and it will have an abortion case it hears in this coming session term, if the conservative majority were to decide to take the court out of the abortion debate and say, you know, it's not a constitutional right, we're not, you know, overturn Roe versus Wade, just leave it up to the states, do you see that lowering the temperature and the salience of abortion as a political issue in America over time?
Which run? The short run, the long run?
Maybe in the long run, but in the short run, it will provoke quite a bit of controversy. Generally,
because we've already gotten used to 40 years of thinking of it as a constitutional right.
And as I said before, about 60% or more of Americans think that the court should not overturn Roe versus Wade. And so the court is typically not too far out in front or not lagging too far behind public opinion. And a decision that just sort of flatly overturns Roe versus Wade would be out of step with public opinion. What might be more in step with public opinion is to say, yes, there's some sort of constitutional right here, but states have more leeway to regulate that right.
Yeah,
and
so
that, I think, would make activists on the left very frustrated, but it would be more in harmony with public opinion generally.
Yeah, I think – I mean, so to be clear, so the court could go a couple directions. And so one would be a perfect reversal. So the court essentially in Roe v. Wade compromised, said – there is a constitutional right to life. There is a constitutional right to choice. And we're going to say that at the point of viability, that's when the constitutional rights flip, right, essentially. And so and then they did their best guess as to when viability was based
on. That's part of the challenge here.
Right,
and that's
exactly
why some of the subsequent states have modified that a little bit.
Right, exactly. So you could imagine so the court could say, you know, we're just going all in on right to life. So there's actually no constitutional right to abortion. There's actually the opposite, a constitutional prohibition on abortion. You could see the court go in the opposite direction and say, actually, abortion all through the 9 month or however many, you know, months of pregnancy is legal. So or constitutional, right? So or they could say the Constitution doesn't speak to this issue, and that's what would throw it back to the states. And that's what we were talking about a little bit before. And I think that for those who would like to see the court out of the question altogether, the argument would go something like this. Short term, it would be super controversial, especially in state legislative elections, right?
It would suddenly be the issue in every state.
Exactly. But it would also be – the idea is that – and Chris did a really nice job of sort of articulating the nuance in a lot of voters' minds. I think what would happen is – a very painful for a lot of voters sort of coming to grips with the issue. You know, they would then have to decide for state legislative elections exactly how they feel on the question. And now over time, I guess at least in theory, by working that out, maybe some consensus could finally arise out of over this issue, something like that. But I think Chris is also right. In the short term, it would be very patchworky. Mm-hmm.
And there would be pressure on Congress to weigh in here as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, right.
To
I think
do
that's
something right. that, as a right. federal standard.
On some right. level, yeah, because funding issues and other things will kind of pull Congress in. But I do think – at least the theory is – over the long run, and with all deference to the people who suffer in the meantime, we would actually understand a little bit better the consequences of various policy approaches. Right. So the very famous phrase from Oliver Wendell Holmes, he calls the states incubators of democracy. Mm-hmm. The idea being that each state can kind of try something out and then the other states can and the nation can learn from individual states.
And what you said there, Grant, is sort of doubly important because what I think people on the left would say is, well, OK, but you're talking about some pretty yeah. core issues in terms of control over your body yeah. and that patchwork may have differential effects on different types of women in ways that could be challenging.
Yeah, right, for sure. And that's why I say with all deference to those who suffer in the meantime.
Yeah,
because,
exactly.
I mean, it wouldn't be a consequence or cost-free process.
No.
But that would be the theory behind advocating getting it back to the states.
Grant Madsen is a professor of U.S. history at Brigham Young University. Thanks a lot for your time today, Grant.
It's always fun.
Chris Karpowitz is a professor of political science and co-director of the Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy at Brigham Young University. Chris, thanks.
Thanks so much, Julie.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, what happens in your brain when a too catchy tune gets stuck there? Just ahead, why criminology experts believe a lot more hate crimes are happening in America than FBI data would suggest. I'm Julie Rose. It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. The FBI received several hundred more reports of hate crimes last year compared to the year before. Of the 7,500 or so incidents reported to police in 2020, more than half targeted victims because of race or ethnicity. Sexual orientation was the second most common reason why victims were targeted for hate crimes. Northeastern University criminologist Jack McDevitt says the FBI statistics undercount the actual incidence of hate crimes in this country. McDevitt has written several books on the subject and directs the Institute on Race and Justice at Northeastern. Professor McDevitt, welcome.
Thanks very much. Good to be on the show.
What are the key trends that you are watching with most interest right now with regard to hate crimes in America?
Well, we're starting to see increases in hate crimes. They had been fairly flat for a while, and they're starting to see increases, and that's troubling. But as you say, the national FBI data drastically undercounts how many hate crimes are out there.
Why? What leads you to believe that?
Well, there's a couple things. There's another way to measure crime, the National Criminal Crime Victimization Survey, which is also done by the Department of Justice. And what they do, as opposed to the FBI goes to local police departments and says, have you had any hate crimes? And they collect data from the police departments. But the victimization survey goes to a random sample of victims across the country and says, have any of these crimes occurred to you? The number, as you said, is a little over 7,000 last year from the FBI, but it's over 200,000 from the National Criminal Victimization Survey. And there's a few reasons
for
that.
Wait, 200,000 incidents
yep.
of hate crime in America, according to the estimate? And this is an estimate based on this nationally representative survey.
Exactly. Just like polling. It's an estimate. They do a representative sample of households and ask them if this occurred to them.
Hmm.
And the number is so dramatically higher.
Wow. Okay. So let's talk about some possible reasons for that.
Sure.
Do the people who answer that survey define hate crime in the same way that the police do or the FBI?
Not necessarily. Some of us, when we'd answer a survey, would say that the reason we were attacked was because of our race and ethnicity or religion or some other characteristic. So that's part of it, is that it could be something that the victim felt, but that there really was no evidence of. But the other thing is that, a lot of hate crime victims don't want to come forward. If you think about it, if you're attacked because of your gender or your race or your ethnicity, you can't do anything about that to change that. You basically carry the cause of your victimization around with you. So in victims we've interviewed over the years, they want it to be anything else. Could you give us any other reason why these people threw rocks through our window? You know, maybe it was kids playing, or maybe they were mistaken looking for a different house. They don't want it to be that, because they could be victimized anytime, any place, because they can't change their race, their ethnicity, their gender orientation. So it's really a very, very threatening crime. Mm. And sometimes victims will try to deny it or try to think for other explanations.
Do they have any motivation to actually call it a hate crime and get it treated as a hate crime?
Well, we don't see a lot of over-reporting of hate crime. In other words, we don't see victims saying it's a hate crime when it wasn't. Mm. There has been some famous cases that have happened, but when we look at data across the country, it's not very common for a victim to make it the claim that it's bias motivated when it really isn't.
And I guess I also was just wondering, you know, what reason would a victim have to call it a hate crime rather than just to report a crime? You know, is there a reason why victims would feel like, oh, I really should report this as a hate crime, even though I really don't want to admit that this was a hate crime?
Well, there is a reason, and it's a great question. The reason is that hate crimes are not targeting an individual. They're targeting a group. And so if we think about an anti-Semitic hate crime, that crime is targeting and trying to send a message to all Jewish people in the community that we don't want you to be part of our community. And so if you're thinking about it and you're saying to yourself, should I report, shouldn't I report it? One of the incentives for reporting is this might get the police to take it seriously so that this person wouldn't go out and harm another person who's Jewish.
Mm. Sometimes I wonder if the term hate crime is a little too broad, just because it seems from the data that I mean, I guess it's technically always a crime, but somebody who like yells a slur or holds up a racist sign at a protest could be reported as a hate incident. Isn't that right?
You're exactly right. But there's two levels. There are hate incidents, which are things that don't rise to the level of a crime, just as the examples you gave.
Okay.
Somebody using a racial or ethnic slur, or someone holding up a poster that has a slur on it. But those are protected free speech in the United States. What we're talking about with a hate crime, though, is a criminal incident that's motivated either entirely or in part by a person's difference.
And so that could range from what to what? I mean, obviously, on the extreme side, we have seen, you know, assaults and murder and mass shootings and, you know, but what on the other end of the spectrum, how far would that hate crime definition go? Down to spray painting something on somebody's
vandalism, okay. Painting a swastika on a Jewish temple or on a mosque. It could be threats or harassment. Calling up an individual at 3 o'clock in the morning every night to wake them up. You know, there's a whole variety of different, we have statutes that prohibit that. And all we're adding to it is that it was motivated by bias.
And that's what that 200,000 number is capturing, not just incidents where people felt like they were targeted in some way, but an actual crime occurred and it was likely motivated by hate.
You're right. It is both the incidents and the crimes. But it's also, an analysis of what caused this thing to happen to me. Mm. You know, if you're asking a victim, why were they assaulted on the street? And they're saying to themselves, I don't know why it happened. You know, if we think of some of the anti-Asian violence we've seen recently, you know, there was no other explanation. I mean, you know, people don't just walk down the street and shove someone to the ground. Mm. They sometimes are acting on biases that they have and trying to send a message to a group of people.
Professor McDevitt, is there any reason or evidence that police officers and police departments are taking a report? Somebody says, look, this thing happened. I was targeted because of my race, ethnicity, sexual orientation. religion, and the police say, well, we're not going to report it as a hate crime to the FBI. Like, does that happen? And if so, why would that happen? What motivation would police have to do that?
It's a great question. And it does happen. And it happens more frequently than we'd like to admit. I can give you a case. We did some research on why police departments did or didn't report. And so we were meeting with a group of officers in a California community, and it was a smaller community. And we said to them, you know, have you had any hate crimes? And they said, well, we thought we had one. But when we investigated, it turned out not to be hate motivated. And I said, well, what was the crime? And they said, well, a Black family moved into an all-white neighborhood and somebody burned a cross on their lawn. And I paused for a second and said, and that wasn't bias motivated? And they said, well, yeah, it wasn't. They said, we went out and investigated. And when we got the cross, it was only about a foot tall. And so for these police officers to be a hate crime, it had to be something like we've seen in movies, a 6-foot cross wrapped in rags set afire. The little crosses they thought was just kids playing around. Unfortunately, they then found that someone broke the windows in the backside of this person's house a month later. Mm-hmm. So I do think that sometimes police officers misunderstand lower level hate crimes and don't think of them as the kinds of threats that they are. And then also we've had places where the police officers are biased and they don't want to take certain kinds of hate crimes. Transgender, for example, there's some communities that if a transgender person came up and said they were attacked, they wouldn't report it as a hate crime. So it's complicated. We've got 18,000 police departments across the country. And, you know, there are lots of officers who have their own biases as well.
If they report it as a hate crime, do they have to treat it differently, act differently? Is there something that they're, you know, is there some, aside from maybe implicit or explicit bias, is there some other motive to not report something as a hate crime to the
Again,
FBI?
It's a great question. One of the things that happens is that you have to prove a different element. So, for example, if we took one of those cases of an Asian individual being shoved down the street and that's on video, it's a pretty easy case to make with the prosecutor that somebody did this. If you have the person pushing him down, you have their picture on video. But then you have to add a different element. Did they do it because of the person's race, ethnicity, LGBTQ status or whatever? And that makes it a little bit more complicated.
Well, it's notoriously difficult for a prosecutor to, to get inside the mind of somebody and sort of
right,
prove.
It is. And generally what the prosecutors use is the language that was being used, that an individual will usually say something to the person when they're attacking them. Like, you shouldn't be here. We want your, don't want your kind here. In the case of anti-Asian violence, you brought the flu here. You know, those kinds of cases are things that can be used in court to prove bias. The other place that we're seeing more and more is, unfortunately, people are using chat rooms on the internet that are sponsored by white supremacist groups or other kinds of hate groups. And they would be coming from those chat rooms and have, you know, said they're going to do something. They're going to go out and show people that they shouldn't be here or something. And you can use that as evidence as well.
So do the police have to, but do they have to follow up in a different way then if they call it a hate crime? Are they going to be held to a different standard? Are there, I don't know, their bosses going to come down from the FBI and say like, okay, you had these many hate crimes. What did y'all do about these?
Yeah, it is a little bit different standard. And we do have communities where they say, it's too complicated. Let's just go with the charge we can prove. Mm-hmm. But the important part is it's important because this is a message crime. It's saying to a whole group of people, we don't want you in our community. And it's important that we charge not only the assault, but also the bias crime, because that sends a message that we care about individuals, that we want them to be in our community, that we don't want haters to be able to act with impunity in our community, that we recognize that some people are attacked because of characteristics that they hold. And so I think it's important that we try to make the arrest, make the charge, and go to court on it. If we lose, we lose. But you still have the other charge of the crime that was the underlying crime. But I think it sends a message to victims that the justice system cares about them try to protect them.
Right. I was wondering, like, who's that message being sent to? Because, I mean, it's certainly if you're going to charge someone who did one of these crimes, that person's getting the message, we consider this hate, and there's an extra level of, you know, of disapproval for what you've done.
Right.
The victim or victims will get that message. But if it's meant to be kind of a message to society writ large, we do not accept this kind of hate in our community, how's that message going to get across? And I guess unless they publicize that this happened, the police department, you know, holds press conferences and goes on a media tour.
Well, you know, prosecutors will charge and the police will make arrests, and that gets noticed. But it's interesting, when we talk to victims after they've been victimized in a hate crime, one of the things they say is it's really, really important that the police take it seriously, because a lot of haters will say after they've beaten someone, don't tell the police about this or we'll come back and get you. Mm-hmm. And the only group in society that can really offer, you know, protection to a victim that legitimately can say, well, we will protect you. And they can't protect everyone all the time, of course, but they can offer protection is the police. So if the police say, we'll protect you, that helps victims heal, because they know, A, that the police are taking it seriously, and B, that there's someone there that they can call that would come to help them if this person comes back and tries to hurt them again.
Jack McDevitt is a criminology professor at Northeastern University, director of the Institute on Race and Justice. Thanks for your time today, Professor.
Thanks, Julie. It was fun. Good conversation.
My pleasure. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, Ciara Hewlett has a conversation about what happens in your brain when a catchy tune gets stuck there on a loop.
I'm Ciara Hewlett. This is Top of Mind.
Shake it off, shake it off.
Many pop songs these days are so catchy they can be torture. I wouldn't be surprised if Shake It Off gets stuck in your head now. Sorry. That constant musical loop is annoying, sure, but it can also mess with your sleep. Michael Skolan has been studying how memorable music affects our brains. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience and director of the Sleep Neuroscience and Cognition Laboratory at Baylor University. He joins me on the line now. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
I have had that song stuck in my head all day preparing for this interview. Why do songs get stuck in our head in the first place?
It's a great question. And I think it relates to how important music is in terms of social connectedness. It was historically a way of passing along stories. And so it has this sort of elevated importance in our brain.
And how does that affect sleep?
Well, this is a new area of research. A few years ago, I was laying in bed trying to fall asleep, and I noticed that I had a song. It wasn't Taylor Swift's song, but it was a song like that, just going over and over and over in my head. And I thought, oh my gosh, I think that this is actually keeping me from falling asleep. And so we designed a few studies to test that hypothesis. And in one of the studies, we just gave a number of questionnaires to people. So we questioned them about their sleep quality. We questioned them about their music listening habits, and we also questioned about how frequently they experienced earworms and at what time during the day versus at night. And one of the things that we found was that a whole lot of people reported having earworms very frequently at night when they were actually trying to fall asleep, or even when they were waking up from sleep. About a third of our participants said that happened to them frequently.
But was that actually causing them, was the earworm, that song stuck in their head, making them wake up? Or did they just wake up and they happen to have a song in their head?
And that's why we needed to run an experimental study. So after we ran this survey study and we found that people who had more of these earworms had worse sleep quality, we brought individuals into our sleep laboratory. And we connected them to something called polysomnography, which is a really fancy way of saying we measured what their brain was doing when they fell asleep. We were able to look at their sleep stages, their sleep quality, and all of that. But the real key was, before they went to bed, we played a series of songs that were catchy. So things like Taylor Swift's and Carly Rae Jepsen, and we had a Journey song in there, things that are known to be catchy. And we were able to experimentally induce people to have earworms. And to the extent we were able to induce these earworms, sleep quality then worsened.
By how much?
Well, in our survey study, if you were getting an earworm relatively frequently at night, you were 2 to 3 times as likely to be a clinically poor sleeper than someone who only got earworms during the day or didn't get earworms at all.
These study participants probably hated you for getting songs stuck in their head on purpose. So what is the criteria, though, here for a song to cause you to sleep poorly? Is it just any song, or does it have to be a catchy song? Does it need to be instrumental versus with lyrics?
Well, traditionally, you would think that it has to be a catchy, fast-paced song, you know, things that we typically think of as stuck in our head. And that was our hypothesis going in. But a theme that we saw across both of our studies was that earworms actually occur more often when you're listening to instrumental music than when you're listening to lyrical music.
So just it could be any kind of instrumental music, like just like classical music that people typically use to try to fall asleep to?
There's some evidence for that. But in our laboratory study, we either played the lyrical version of Taylor Swift's hit song, or we played the instrumental version where everything's identical. You just remove the lyrics. And we found that people got earworms in both groups, but they were about twice as likely to get an earworm if they were just listening to the instrumental music.
Really?
So there might be something about them, you know, generating the lyrics in their head and trying to sing along, and that generation just kind of sends you on this track over and over again.
Huh. And why is it that having an earworm, having a song stuck in your head, why would that make you have poor sleep?
We're still trying to untangle that. I mean, obviously, if you're having an earworm that's at bedtime and you're thinking of that earworm rather than being able to relax and fall asleep, that's pretty obvious. But why would an earworm in the middle of the night cause you to awaken from sleep? That's going to be more challenging. But what the current evidence is showing is that earworms music, like other memories, undergo this special processing when we fall asleep. We typically call this process consolidation, but all that really means is that you're stabilizing memories, you're reactivating memories and stabilizing them. So in the case of earworms, these musical melodies are being reactivated during sleep, and maybe they get a little overexcited, and that causes a little bit of an awakening.
So it's like they're continuing to play in your head even as you're sleeping. The songs mm-hmm. that are stuck in your head just never leave.
And we actually saw evidence for that. So there are specific brain activity markers of memories being reactivated. There are things called these frontal slow oscillations. Fancy term, but what it means is that memories from earlier in the day are being reactivated. And we found that people who were reporting earworms at night were showing a lot more of these frontal slow oscillations. And here was the really interesting thing. They showed more of this activity over the part of the brain that we know experiences earworms or processes earworms when we're awake.
Why would the brain keep processing those when we're sleeping? What's the point of that?
Again, it's a big question. It's a great question. We don't have an answer to that, other than there's something special about musical memories or musical melodies in the brain. There's something connected to language learning and to social interactions and to storytelling across the ages, where it's apparently very, very highly prioritized by the brain.
Are some people more prone to having this happen to them, that musical process while they're sleeping, than others?
We know that musicians are much more likely to experience earworms. And my guess is in the radio industry, you do so much with musical melodies. You're constantly thinking about it, that my guess is earworms are very common amongst radio hosts.
Could someone's sleep be affected by music even if they didn't have a song stuck in their head then? If our brain does process music at night, do we have to have an earworm right before bed to have this disruption of sleep?
Well, I mean, there are many things that can disrupt sleep, right? So the first thing that always comes to people's mind is screen time before bed. Any sort of bright light, whether it's your phone, whether it's working on a laptop, that is a major hindrance to nighttime sleep quality.
But could music affect your sleep, even if you listen to music hours before and don't have a song stuck in your head right before you go to bed?
Well, what we found in our studies is that it will affect you if it then triggers an earworm. We didn't find any evidence that listening to music that doesn't trigger an earworm has any effect on sleep quality.
I'm speaking with Michael Skolin. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience and director of the Sleep Neuroscience and Cognition Laboratory at Baylor University. So does this mean, Professor Skolin, that we shouldn't listen to music before going to bed?
No, I think it means we need to listen to it in moderation. So if you're spending hours every single day listening to music and you're experiencing earworms, then you probably want to do that in moderation. The other thing you probably want to do is listen to music in other parts of your house outside of the bedroom. Anything that you're doing in the bedroom gets associated with the sleep environment. So for example, I mean, if you're listening to music and you're sitting on the bed, even if you turn that music off, your brain is still going to be kind of thinking about musical melodies. And so it's going to be more likely to trigger an earworm in that context.
So your brain associates your room, your bed with music. And then even though you're not thinking about music, it'll automatically go there just because that's something that you normally do.
Absolutely. We see this similar thing in students all the time who study in the bedroom. They associate studying and the stress and the energy expended on studying with the sleep environment. And that ends up being a hindrance to their sleep, because even when they put their books away, their heart is still kind of racing. Their mind is still kind of going about school.
Why then do so many people listen to music before bed? It seems like that's often a thing we hear, you know, and it's a relaxing thing. But it seems like it isn't always a good thing. Why do we think that it is?
Well, because it feels good, right? It improves our mood, and that's fantastic. And that's why you wouldn't ever want to cut it out. But you can have too much of a good thing. And if you are listening to music too much and you're getting a lot of earworms and you're also experiencing poor sleep quality, hey, time for a change.
So the people in your study then, if they listened to music just more in general in their life, did that mean that they got more earworms and then they'd get poor sleep? And so we should listen to music less in general? Is there like a magic number of how much music to be listening to a day?
You have the right correlation that the more people are listening to music, the more likely they are to get earworms and the more likely they are to have poor sleep quality. I think you got to think of it on an individual level, though. If you're listening to a lot of music, but you're never having earworm problems, then, it's probably not a big problem. Or if you are getting earworms, but you're just this magical 8-hour night sleeper and you wake up feeling really refreshed, then again, don't worry about it. But if you are having some sleep difficulties, it's incumbent upon us, for thriving, to be able to look at what we're doing during the day, things like listening to music too much screen time, and adjust those habits.
Does getting songs stuck in our head happen more often today? This is a bigger problem than it ever used to be. Is music more catchy now?
We think so, right? Because musicians are now designing their songs specifically to be catchy. We know with certain beats and with certain rise and fall and pitch that leads to a catchier lyric. And that's not something that they knew 100 years ago.
And do earworms also happen more often at night? Is that why we see more of this problem when people are sleeping?
They occur about equally as often at night as during the day.
Okay. And what do you do then if you are going to bed, you've got a song stuck in your head and you don't want it to affect how you sleep? What do you do?
I always recommend a writing activity. So we've known for many years that if you take out a piece of paper and you just write out everything that's on your mind, all of your worries, all of your to-do list, you fall asleep faster. And this activity has the additional benefit of it engages your mind away from that song, which we know is important for getting rid of earworms. You need to be able to engage your mind a little bit and distract it a little bit from that music to get it to get out of your head.
And why would there be other benefits too of having that routine of being just writing down? Does it help you to, is it because it's also something that's not super demanding, or you want something that's more demanding cognitively? And so then that helps engage your brain so that you get rid of the song.
Right. It's somewhat cognitively demanding, but not as demanding as, you know, you're playing video games or something and now you're really worked up and it's going to be hard to fall back asleep. We know from this literature on that's called expressive writing, that it also helps to remove worries and it helps to remove anxiety. So this came out of the clinical psychology field decades ago. And now we've discovered that it also helps with falling asleep at night.
Okay. And I've heard before that some people think that you can, if you have a song stuck in your head, that you should listen to that song to get it out of your head. Is that actually effective?
It's not as effective as distracting yourself with cognitive activities such as writing.
Okay. Well, hopefully we didn't get everyone's song stuck in everyone's head through this conversation. Michael Scullin is a professor of psychology and neuroscience and director of the Sleep Neuroscience and Cognition Laboratory at Baylor University. Thank you so much for your time today for explaining this to us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Ciara Hewlett. This is Top of Mind. On our show, we cover so many different topics, and you can find them all on our website. For example, how do you feel about kimchi and kombucha? Recently on Top of Mind, we heard about new research that shows eating fermented foods regularly can do more to boost the good bacteria in your gut than just eating fiber. So you can find that conversation on our website, byuradio.org/topofmind.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. First this hour, the rise of hyper-education in America, where already successful students get private tutoring.
Parents are either directly or inadvertently saying, we don't trust our teachers to be giving our students, our kids, what they need to learn. And so we're willing to go to the private marketplace and pay for it on the side.
Also, the one thing every family can do to improve the mental health of both parents and kids. That's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. Private tutoring centers like Kumon, Kaplan, and Mathnasium are a booming business all across the country. But it's not kids struggling in school who are driving the growth in these services. It's kids who are already excelling. Amherst College professor Pavan Dhingra says there is an education arms race in the United States right now, with families feeling pressured to ensure their kids are always ahead of their peers. So they're seeking what Dhingra calls hyper-education. That's the name of his new book, Hyper-Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. And Pavan Dhingra joins me now. Thanks for taking time today, Professor. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about one of the families you spent time with in researching this book.
I appreciate that. So I spent time with, you know, dozens of families whose children are involved, as you already said, in after-school education centers or academic competitions or some combination, seeking to give their kids a leg up. I spent time with one family at their home in Connecticut where the daughter was preparing for the National Scripps National Spelling Bee. And the mother, I sat with him in the morning. The mother sat with the daughter, who was a teenager, kind of going through word after word of German origin vocabulary. And the daughter would just, the mother would read off words off her computer. The daughter would, you know, spell them out very quickly, words I've never heard before, much less could spell. What struck me about the environment was just how normal it felt to them, right? Spending 2 to 3 hours just going over German root words had the air of just kind of making breakfast or making, you know, or just doing folding the laundry. It didn't seem strange. It wasn't, there wasn't a lot of arguing. There was no pushing and pulling. It was a family ritual. And one thing that struck me about the families I spoke to, for a number of them, right, when the students were really, when the children were really invested in what they were doing, it felt like a family ritual, something that parents would do together with the kids or the kids could do on their own. But other times, it really was a struggle. The kids just resented the work they were having to do. They would make snide remarks about it. The parents would be kind of trying to offer guidance, but reprimanding them at the same time. And you saw a lot of that as well. One family, their child was kind of bouncing off the walls, trying to do everything he could besides the math work he was supposed to be doing while the parents and I were talking. It was clear that, you know, he just wasn't interested in this, but to the parents, it was a really important, you know, part of their education.
So in most of the cases where this is a like an embedded part of the family ritual, those are situations where there is some sort of competition also involved. The way you describe the Scripps Spelling Bee family makes me think of, you know, like it is in a lot of families when one of the kids is a competitive soccer player or swimmer or something. And so like the whole family's life revolves around meets on the weekends or, you know, matches on with traveling teams, right?
Like people will drive like hours to get to a competition. It's like they would to, like, you know, the AU baseball game that their child is playing or softball game. So it was in the competitions that the children oftentimes had a more intrinsic interest. But even then you would find students who, you know, felt kind of compelled to do it because their parents had signed them up. I met on one child at a competition, an academic competition, who was clearly just like, you know, rather be anywhere else in the universe besides here. And he said to me, he's missing his friend's birthday party to be here at this competition. And I said, well, is there anything about this that you're enjoying? You're trying to find something for him to be smiling about? He just said, no, nothing. Mm. And so it was clear that, you know, it was, you know, his parents just literally dragged him there.
And so for families like that, then what is the motivation? I mean, on the one hand, if your kid expresses a real interest and affinity for math and wants to do these math competitions or spelling, you know, wants to be a spelling bee champion, like that, I think that that's a model that a lot of families can recognize. Your kid loves to play this instrument. Now, this is a part of, you know, you want to encourage that. But there is a lot of what you describe in this book of hyper-education being pursued, not so that that child can win a competition, but basically for the sake of having more than your peers in the classroom. Talk to me about why parents are putting their kids through that.
Yeah, I appreciate that distinction you're making between the kinds of families, because it's not a single kind of template for all of them. But you're right. A lot of the families were putting their kids into these spaces, even though the children themselves rather be elsewhere. And what's striking about it is that, you know, if you have families whose kids are, you know, well below grade level, and I'm talking about, you know, seventh graders, third graders, even kindergartners, or they were in schools that the parents believe were just, you know, underfunded and under-resourced and ill-prepared or something else, you could understand parents saying, listen, my kid just needs something that the school's not going to be able to provide them, or they're not able to catch, they need to catch up to grade level, so we have to do something outside of school. But hyper-education is growing, as you already mentioned, among families who don't fit that profile whatsoever, right? There are kids who are already at grade level or slightly above grade level. There's no external pressure. There's no SAT test they have to prepare for or AP honors course in biology they have to get a grade on. And their schools are relatively well-ranked and well-resourced. In fact, most parents I interviewed moved to their towns because of the reputation of the schools. And yet parents still said, we want more education for our kids than what they're getting in the school system. And the reason there are various reasons as to why. So one key reason is that parents believed that unless they did something extra for their kids would be behind when it counted more. For instance, come high school or college application time. If you think that other kids in your school are doing something extra, then that this changes what it means to be, you know, doing well. It raises the bar. And so unless you're also doing that, then your kid will be behind relative to them. Other parents said that, you know, I grew up with extra education as part of my childhood. And so to not do something extra would feel really strange. A lot of immigrant parents said this, but also a lot of U.S., you know, raised parents, American-born parents would say, you know, this, I got to where I am into the middle class, for instance, by studying and working hard. And our kids need to learn that value. So a lot of parents spoke about extra math on the side, not just about the, you know, get my kid doing better in terms of fractions or decimals or whatever, but about making sure my kids appreciated the value of hard work. In other words, there was some kind of a moral teaching going on, a certain kind of ethical or kind of proper upbringing that was at stake for parents beyond just the test scores or the reading assessments or anything else. So parents had a lot of conflicting and multiple reasons why they drove their kids into these hyper-education spaces.
And how do the kids perceive it? I mean, aside from, in some cases, resenting it, what's the point when they express to you, like, what are you worried about? What are you working on? Why are you doing this? What do they tell you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I spoke to a lot of children in the process, and a lot of them would say, you know, a lot of them felt compelled to do it because their parents wanted them to do it. And they split pretty much evenly in half between those who said, if I didn't have to do it, I would quit. And if I didn't have to do it, I would still do it because I enjoy it. And, you know, for those who had kind of, like, as you mentioned before, some kind of external connection to it, like there's a competition they're trying to win, and competing has an inherent value to students, to kids, and to grownups. So there was something about it that was beyond just kind of just taking extra worksheets. If they had something intrinsic in it that they felt was useful to them or appealing to them, they're more likely to stick with it. But for other kids, it just felt like a chore. And I talked to educators and mental health experts who really worry about this, that when the academics starts to feel like a chore to students, then there's really a lot of long-term problematic consequences. And so students really varied, but you know, a number of them were, again, you know, motivated by this, felt there was a meaning behind it. They enjoyed studying together with their peers. They saw, as I mentioned before, it was like a family ritual, something that they just understood as part of their day-to-day. But others had to be bribed, threatened. Like one mother told me, I heard of one mother saying, you know, she doesn't let her kid go play soccer until he finishes this extra math work. And that's a very typical kind of response. Another mother would check on her student's homework, extra homework, before she could go out and do something else she wanted to do. So a lot of that kind of pressure or expectations put on kids.
What does this mean for the classroom where this kid goes to school during the day and the kid has already at Kumon, you know, way advanced beyond what his teacher is teaching in math that day?
Yeah, the teachers I spoke to, they dwelled on this a lot. And so I'm glad you brought this up. Teachers already have a Herculean job. I think, if you know, all the remote teaching that we as parents had to help our kids with, you know, prove that to us if we didn't know it already. But when you have children in schools with such varied levels of preparation, it makes the teacher's job even harder. And so teachers witnessed students who had that Kumon teaching or something else. They would, in many ways, appear like excellent students because they were able to do the work quickly. They had fewer errors. And parents commented how their kids' grades improved, or how the speed at which they did their homework hastened. And so all these, you know, they're getting the money's worth, they think. But teachers would dwell not so much on those aspects, but on the more subtle and long-term consequences of tutored children. So some of the more subtle ways in which there were problems was that students who had this exposure to a math concept 2 months earlier at Kumon would then be bored in class. And they would kind of perform that boredom. They would say, oh, I already know this. And they would be less interested. And teachers said, listen, their concern is those students end up actually having a weaker foundation for what the math concept is than those who had not been exposed to it earlier and are actually paying attention in class. And they may end up being less strong in math, ironically, because yes, they can do the problems fast. They don't have many errors, but they don't fully understand what they're learning, what they're doing. And unless you have that strong foundation, that when the concepts get more difficult, those students won't be as prepared. So that's one of the concerns that teachers had for such students.
They kind of resent?
A few teachers would actually kind of go so far as to say, yes, they really were bothered that parents would just partly because they thought they were undervaluing what teachers actually did. One teacher told me that parents think they can come in and teach some of these classes because they themselves are, well, I have a master's degree in science, and so I can just come in here and teach your chemistry class, or I can teach your math class. And one teacher said, if parents saw what we did, handling so many different kinds of students and concepts, they would give us a medal if they really understood. But it's actually the opposite that's happening. Parents are either directly or inadvertently saying, we don't trust our teachers to be giving our students, our kids, what they need to learn. And so we're willing to go to the private marketplace and pay for it on the side, even though, again, we're in schools that are well-resourced and well enough ranked. And teachers would feel that, more than concerned about their own their respect they were getting or not getting, they really worried about what it was doing to the kids and the stress, putting aside how much they actually learn, just the stress and the mental health aspects and the anxiety that teachers are seeing among school children is skyrocketing. It's like, I don't want to use the word epidemic because we're in the middle of a real medical epidemic, but that notion of it being a major concern of our mental health is accurate.
Like what? And what are teachers, they seeing? What is it that has them so worried?
Yeah. So for instance, I talked to a third grade teacher who says that she sees students who are so stressed they become nonverbal. They just don't speak in class, even though they know what they're doing. And that's not typical. I talked to a kindergarten teacher who sees kids prone to crying because they're just caring so much. And you see high school teachers referring to cheating as becoming a more common practice because students don't see the actual goal of education as having its own worth. It becomes just something else I have to get done. In other words, if parents put me into more and more education outside of school without kind of explaining to me why I'm not learning enough in school as it is, why I need more and more of this thing I don't really care about in the first place, then my reaction is going to be just to get it done as fast as possible. I don't value this anymore. I just see it as an obligation, as a chore. And so if I can find ways of getting around that obligation or making it faster by cheating, for instance, that just seems to make sense to me. Cheating, in other words, loses some of its like moral kind of problematic elements and instead becomes a relatively efficient means to an end. And that makes sense to a student if they don't appreciate what the end actually is. And the end is not getting a good grade, right? We want that. But the end really is to become a lifelong learner, a curious person, a thoughtful person. But we lose sight of that, and kids lose sight of that when they're kind of put in these hyper-education spaces where it's all about, assessment, completing the assignment, moving on, moving up, moving up.
Mm. And what effect, if any, does this have on the other students who are not pursuing hyper-education in a classroom?
Students who are, doing just fine in school, keeping up with grade level, start to feel, frankly, stupid because their peers are doing the work that they're doing faster than them with fewer mistakes and standing out in a class or in a subject. And the student, the non-hyper-educated student feels, like I'm pretty good at this. I'm pretty good at this topic or, math, for instance, or geography or whatever else. But because I'm not hyper-educated, I start to feel inadequate. Other mental health expert told me that there's this term she refers to as academic bullying, which I talk about in the book, which is this notion that unless you're taking, extra AP classes and you've been on this fast track for years since before middle school, that you are not going to get into college. You're not smart. You're just, you're average at best. And kids see, students see other kids kind of excelling over them, and they start to question their own abilities, even though, again, they're right on track. They're at grade level. They're doing just fine. And in an earlier era or in a different space, they would be considered, the bright lights in a classroom.
I'm speaking with Pavan Dhingra, who is a professor of American Studies at Amherst College, author of Hyper Education, Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. There's an aspect of this that we haven't yet discussed, which is a really important piece in order to understand why hypereducation is happening and what effect it's having, and that is that Asian American parents are particularly prone to pursuing this kind of extracurricular enhancement. So that's what we need to talk about next, but we do need to take a very quick break here on Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll be right back. Thanks for tuning into Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. I'm speaking with Pavan Dhingra. He is a professor of American Studies at Amherst College, author of an interesting new book called Hypereducation: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. He dives into what he calls an education arms race taking place in the United States, where families of children who are already meeting expectations in school, they're in some cases already at the top of their class, are pursuing additional extracurricular educational enhancement, private tutoring centers like Kumon, Kaplan, Mathnasium, Sylvan, spending hours and hours and hours a week, lots of pressure on these kids, hundreds of dollars of investment, and for what and why? Professor Dhingra, as you point out in the book, there are a lot of Asian American families, Chinese American, Korean American, Indian American families, and especially immigrant parents who are pursuing hyper education for their children. Why?
A lot of these immigrant families came to the United States because they themselves were, in effect, hyper educated in their country. So, I mean, not to get into a whole conversation around immigration, but for many of these families to come here, they had to be at the top of their class, you know, get a graduate degree and secure, you know, a coveted job in the United States. So we're not talking about this, you know, the standard persons of any country. And so if you grew up a certain way and it served you well, because it got you, elite opportunities, then it's natural to think that's a helpful way of raising your own kids. And we all do this. It's something we all do. I do for my kids. I'm sure, you know, parents just kind of take for granted how to raise your own kid. And so it feels awkward or even somehow improper to not do this for your child if you yourself were raised in a certain way, or even if you weren't exposed to it personally, you know, it was out there and among your friends and peers and where you grew up, to not do it for your kid if you have the availability to do so. So that's one of the reasons. But another reason is that a lot of parents I spoke to said, you know, listen, you know, we don't have many, we're immigrants to this country. We're new to this country. We don't have a lot of the taken for granted connections and wherewithal and knowledge of how things work here that a lot of our peers do, that my coworkers do, or our neighbors do. So to make sure our kids have an edge and can succeed, because they don't have, as one parent told me, I don't know the secret handshake to get into the boardrooms, or I don't have connections to help my kid, or, you know, through my fraternity or sorority, to help my kid get it, you know, an internship or get connected to a college. We have to make sure our kids stand out in some respect. And because these parents excelled in academics, which is why they were able to come to the U.S., standing out in math, reading, science, you know, whatever else, becomes the most likely venue or scenario for their kids to excel. So doubling down on education makes a lot of sense. And one last thing I'll quickly say is that a lot of parents want their kids to stand out and they double down on things. And sports is the most popular after-school activity in America by far. And, you know, a lot of these families do sports for their kids, but they don't see sports as the best, most likely venue for their kids to stand out, given their own, you know, lack of familiarity with a lot of American sports and the fact that they didn't grow up, you know, hardcore in any kind of sport. So for a lot of reasons, academics becomes a key venue and avenue for their kids to stand out.
That contrast you described between a family's commitment to sports for their child versus a family's commitment to, let's say, competitive spelling. The fact that that a white family would not be like criticized or looked down upon for going all in with their daughter's ice skating training or gymnastics training or, you know, whatever, which might be requiring an equal, if not more, you know, time commitment and rearranging of the family's life and financial commitment. Right. But you'll get in the school system you described and just kind of in culture in general, this sort of looking down on those weird, you know, Indian Americans who are so overbearing and so like serious about their spelling. Right.
Yeah, there's a kind of tiger parenting stereotype we have out there that it's easy to latch onto and criticize these parents for doing something. But and I think with the ice hockey example is a great one. We often think that, well, you know, the kid plays ice hockey because they just love ice hockey. And the kid does spelling or math because the parents are forcing them to do it. And that's not always the case. Some kids don't like ice hockey, but their parents put them in it. And after a while, they start to like it if they get good at it. And some kids, you know, really do like math and spelling, and they at least don't mind it. So we have some of these kind of assumptions in our head that leads us to judge some parents one way and other parents a very different way, even though when you peel back one layer, they're actually very similar, right? And same kind of ideas and same kind of goals.
Yeah. You do have some quotes from teachers who I'm sure would not consider themselves, you know, racist or engaged in harmful stereotypes, who it's quite clear feel like these Asian American parents are doing it wrong you know, by pushing their kids. What's going on there?
Yeah, and that's right. Because in these parents, I don't refer to these teachers as racist, and they're well-meaning. I got, I spent a lot of time talking to them. They were really sincere in their concerns for the students. But like a lot of us, they have a lot of presumptions around why parents do what they do or how kids are raised. So they would assume that children who are in extra academics are, you know, forced without their will, against their will to do this. And they assume that the parents don't express affection or caring for the kids, but instead, you know, raise them with some kind of iron fist, and that they, the teachers are they're real parents somehow. Like a couple of people, said, I'm a mother, and I treat these kids as like I'm their mother because their parents don't know how to raise them, in effect, which is really very demeaning, frankly. I mean, even if it's well intentioned. It's going to be inappropriate to make a lot of assumptions around what's going on in a child's home unless you actually know what's going on. But, like a lot of us, and again, I'm not judging them per se, they have a lot of working assumptions around how Asian parents raise their kids versus, the loving, sincere white family will treat their kids even when they engage in the same activity. And so there's these misunderstandings then lead the teachers and mental health experts to treat the parents in somewhat demeaning ways. And why that's a problem in the long run is that it doesn't help fix the issue, right? If there are kids who are being stressed out and being tiger parented or overparented, if you treat parents as if they don't know anything and they don't really know how to raise their kids, that's not going to communicate to them. They're not going to respond well to that. So the children still suffer in the end. So unless we really understand what's going on in homes and we take care, we address all kinds of hyperparenting, whether it be in the sports field or in the academic arena, we're not going to be helping the kids who need it the most.
What would change, do you think, if teachers and psychologists understood that one of the main motivations for these immigrant parents is that they're just doing what they were raised as and that they're doing the one thing they feel like they can do and that they have control over to give their kids to compensate for the opportunities that they don't have because they're immigrants?
One is they would talk to the children in a way that did not create this false choice, this forced choice between your parents or your school. A lot of teachers and mental health experts talk to the kids as if somehow, the teachers and the school really cared for them and their parents did not understand that. And that's a horrible way of trying to get in touch with kids and making them feel they have to choose between their parents and the school. That's one key distinction, I think, one key problem I think would change and get better. Also, if we understand that parents are motivated, the parents are coming from a good place when they're doing things that could have problematic outcomes, it then helps us decide, okay, well, if parents really are worried about getting into college for your kid and academics is the best way of doing so, let's talk to you in a more well-rounded way about what college admissions actually looks like and how you can help your kids get into college without going down a singular path. In other words, let's meet parents where they're at. or if you tell parents, I know you grew up with this kind of educational space, and so you think doing it for, and it served you well, and you think doing it for your kids is the right thing to do. Well, that could be true, right? But it depends on your kid. So let's understand where you're coming from, respect that, and then allows parents to listen to the teachers and experts when they're trying to communicate alternative ways of thinking about their kid's future. Because now I actually know, you know me, you get me. And so I'm willing to listen to you, as opposed to you treating me as some kind of caricature, in which case, you know, I'm happy to move on without consulting you at all.
How well does hyper-education work to achieve the goals these parents set out for their kids? Like, are these kids getting into schools, getting better careers than they would otherwise?
You know, the kids who are motivated by what they're doing and take it on themselves, this is what I care about, then they learn a lot of useful skills just beyond the academics. They learn about how to manage their time well, how to like persevere and through difficult situations and put up with studying even when it's not, when there are other things that could be more enjoyable in the short term to do. And those kids who learn those skills, which is hard, you can't just lecture those skills into someone, you have to actually live them. If those students who are enjoying the process and they're doing the kind of sacrificing and self-awareness in pursuit of something they care about, they actually do quite well, right? I mean, they learn, I mean, on top of all of the academics that they're learning along the way. And I talk to them as adults, and they're well-balanced. They're not, you know, they don't look back at their childhood with great resentments. They're social, they have friends, they have loving family. I mean, there's no problem that they're surfaced 10 years later based on that kind of upbringing. But if you have a child who is doing this at the will of the parents as opposed to their own, and parents are not responding to that and changing it and just recognizing their own the mismatch, then those students tend to grow up. They can do fine in school, but the passion for it and the love of it is not there. And that's when you see burnout. That's when you see mental health problems really surface. And schools are seeing this. Burnout is a major issue on college campuses across the country. And those are the kinds of kids who are more prone to that.
You also found that sometimes parents encourage enhanced education for their kids, or pursue it against their will even, for non-academic reasons. It's not just about getting into the best college and getting the right scholarship. What are some of the other reasons?
Yeah, that was actually really surprising to me. And, you know, I spoke to a lot of, you know, white U.S. born and raised parents and a lot of immigrant parents, and they all said this. So that was really extra surprising. They would refer to extra education as helping make sure their kids not just did well in school, but became quote unquote good kids, moral kids. They would say things like, one mother I spoke to said, you know, I grew up kind of working class, lower middle class, and now, you know, my husband and I have, you know, good jobs, and we're like, you know, we're solidly middle class, you know, eking into upper middle class. And so we can buy our kids, you know, if they want a pair of jeans, I can buy my son a pair of jeans. I can buy them whatever they want or need. But now I'm in danger of creating a spoiled brat, right? So how do I make sure I don't create a spoiled brat? And they saw extra math as something they did once a week, primarily to instill for the kid a sense that achievement takes work. Success, financial success, or other kinds of success takes sacrifice. They weren't really worried about how much math the kid knew. They wanted to find some way or set of ways to instill a kind of understanding of what it meant to be a proper kind of student or person thinking down the road, willing to give up what's fun for the long-term gain. Other parents said that, you know, kids who are involved in hyper education, they're less likely to, you know, have premarital sex, or less likely to, you know, smoke marijuana. They literally said these kinds of things. You know, and again, not just immigrant parents at all. They refer to those kids as being more likely to be respectful to their parents and caring. It was a whole set of like just, you know, ethical and proper personalities and character building that was at stake, because they saw, you know, video games and even sports to a degree as like, they're obviously fun, the immediate gratification, But it takes a certain kind of person who's going to say, I'm willing to put in the extra work to do, to push me down the road in the long run. And that will then lead me to these other attributes that are, we want for our kids to kind of go together, right? It's one kind of cohesive set of cultural attributes.
Professor Dhingra, one of the key insights, core insights of your book, Hypereducation, is that this urge to get more for your already successful child, enhance their existing education, is in fact the logical conclusion of all of the criticism that has been levied at public education in America over the last 20 years. Walk me through that argument.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because we're talking about the parents and focusing on them, but they live in a context. We all live in a context that's kind of making sense of our choices. And our school system, you know, and again, we've seen this with remote learning, our teachers have been underappreciated and undervalued for quite a while. And this goes back to, you know, there's decades of literature on this. But just think about something in our, you know, the relatively recent past, which is No Child Left Behind. You know, and I'm not judging it as a, and there's a lot of things about it that are positive and negative, so I'm not going to get in on that. But the point around it is that it basically took a lot of the authority out of teachers' hands and put it into the standardized testing to decide how much a student knows and what constitutes an educated student. And even from then on, from then until now, there's been an erosion in how much authority we give teachers and how much trust we have in their schools in general to educate our kids. And so it makes sense for parents to say, hey, listen, I'm hearing left and right about how our teachers need to be more, you know, more assessed, how our schools are failing kids. I should have my kid, you know, following the Gates Foundation with all of its critiques of small schools and everything else. Nothing's working in education these days, it seems. So as a parent, I hear this, I read these stories, or I hear this kind of rhetoric. And so it'd be irresponsible of me as a parent to not give my kid extra education outside of school to make sure they're learning as much as they should. Because our school system has been painted as inadequate, inefficient, inappropriate even. And so parents listen to this, they hear this, and the sad reality, or maybe the silver lining, depending on how you look at it, is that many of our schools are doing just fine, right? A lot of these critiques are misplaced. Yes, we have a lot of challenges in our schools, but to a significant degree, those challenges are what's happening in our communities outside of our schools that happen that get brought into this, to the classroom. Mm. And by focusing on the school as the center of the problem, and therefore I, a parent, will find education outside of school in Kumon or elsewhere, we're really not focusing on the right issues, and we're then making choices that aren't serving our children really properly. I have two kids, right? One now is in high school, and one's in middle school. And I can appreciate this desire for hypereducation. I get it. I've been very hopefully clear that I'm not just saying it's inherently bad. I talk a lot in the book about when it's a good choice for your kids. But part of the context behind it has been, I think, a mischaracterization of our school system.
And also paralleled with the other maybe big trend in American public education over the last 20 years, which has been this argument that the private market can do it better. And so the two of those have just been perfectly married. And you've got the underlying fears and misperceptions that parents have about how well their school can possibly do for their kids. And then on top of that, you have, oh, and by the way, here's this whole flourishing ecosystem, right, of private solutions that can come to your rescue.
Yeah. And in these companies actually advertise, in that vein, you'll often see advertisements saying, you know, we do not offer a cookie cutter approach to education, implying that the school is just treating kids as if they're like, you know, people on an assembly line in a factory without any kind of nuance or caring for, you know, the particular learning styles. This is exactly the ecosystem, as you said, the ecosystem they're in. And as I talk about this, how this is not just a trend in education, it's a trend elsewhere, but the implications in education are very much more problematic than elsewhere. And ironically, right, many of our public school teachers are some of the best trained teachers there are compared to private school teachers. And so we have very well-trained teachers who are being framed as out of touch, not knowing these, you know, how to teach, and treating schools, kids as if they're in a factory line, who just kind of teach to the middle, but don't care at all about those in the higher or lower rungs of the ladder.
Professor Dingra, finally, we have largely talked about hyper-education as a potentially problematic thing. But can you describe for me a situation where it is great for a child?
Yeah, and again, I'm glad you brought this up because I don't want to paint it in a single brush stroke. And again, we had our kids in these kind of things at some point earlier, too. I get why parents do this, and I can appreciate it. So it can be really useful for kids who are... And I talk about this in the book, who demonstrate an interest in the topic that they're doing, and that in the parent is communicating with the teacher about what the child is learning outside of school. Here's the advice I give parents, which is when you are at the dinner table with your kids, when your kid is tying their shoes before they go outside to play, when it's bedtime, what do they talk about? What are the kids bringing up to you? What motivates them? Try to find ways that connect your kind of hyper-education wants to what they already care about, as opposed to forcing them into a certain kind of box that you think is the only way for them to learn. And when you connect with their interests and you find ways of building on that, then you really see their learning growing, their creativity growing, their interest growing. And it's never a perfect kind of blossoming, as if somehow there can be some, you have to force them into things or convince them to do things, but you'll find that they will respond much more positively in that kind of way. And hypereducation, whether it be extra math classes or competitions, can be a great fit for students who, show an interest in this, respond well, but parents really need to be mindful about what kind of learning is going on in these centers, what's going on in the school system, and being constant communication with the teachers to see how their kids are responding in school once they're in these extra educational spaces.
The book is Hyper Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. Pavan Dingra is a professor of American Studies at Amherst College. Professor, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, why family dinner matters. It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. Family therapist Anne Fischel has one top piece of advice for families. It's this: eat a meal together regularly. Could be dinner or breakfast, takeout or home cooked. Fischel is a clinical professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and co-founder of the Family Dinner Project. I know you bring this up to a lot of families. What is their number one piece of pushback to you when you say, when you encourage them to eat together? They say, yeah, but... what?
Yes, but we're too tired. Yes, but our schedules don't match up. Mm. Yes, but we go to all that trouble and then our partner or our kids don't like what we've cooked, and why go to all that trouble? Or why go to all that trouble and then all we do is fight at the table?
It's all very good, yes buts. So let's take a few of those one by one if we could, starting with, we're tired and we're busy.
Yeah, so I would say, the food is the least important part of family dinner. As counterintuitive as that sounds, mm-hmm. Food brings everybody to the table, but it's what happens around the table. It's the atmosphere. If it's warm and welcoming and everybody has a chance to speak and feel listened to, that's what creates the incredible, scientifically proven mental health benefits and physical benefits and cognitive benefits. So, if families are getting stressed out by having to cook a perfectly roasted chicken or, source out heirloom tomatoes, it's really not about that. You can take shortcuts. You could make breakfast foods for dinner, which tend to be quicker or easier. You could have takeout.
that's really fine as well. It may not have all the nutritional benefits of a home-cooked meal, but you get the other benefits.
And how long does it have to be? How long of a meal are we talking in order to get the benefits?
Well, that's partly a developmental question. Mm-hmm. So for young kids, if you could get a toddler to sit for dinner for 5 minutes and start to build that habit so that by the time they're 12, they're sitting happily at the dinner table for 20 minutes, which is the average amount that an American family has dinner. Mm. So start with something manageable. And when kids get restless and need to get up and run around, you might say, while you're up, bring the napkins and then come back. But you might just want to let them go and hope that those 5 minutes were really positive and you're building something. Mm.
Building what? Expand, if you would, Professor Fischel, on what the scientifically proven benefits of eating together are.
Sure. So for kids and adolescents, there are 25 years of studies that show that regular family dinners, and those could be regular family breakfasts or lunches, as you were saying, we found that those were maybe easier or more frequent during the pandemic. But anyway, there are 25 years of studies that show that regular mealtime, shared mealtime, is great for the body, the brains, and the mental health of kids and adolescents. So for mental health, shared mealtime is associated with lower rates of eating disorders and substance abuse and depression and anxiety, behavioral problems at school. You know, it's no wonder that as a family therapist, I say only half jokingly, you know, if more families had dinner together, I might almost be out of business because so much of what I try to do clinically happens with regular meals.
Well, how can it be that sitting down together for 15 or 20 minutes a couple of times a week or maybe every day could be doing all of those things? I mean, it makes more sense to me that the families that have the wherewithal to sit down and eat together regularly are families that are just by nature less likely to have the anxiety and the problems that you described.
Right. So that has been factored out in many of the studies, so that it turns out that even families who already are connected and tuned into their kids and organized and all of those good things, they get benefits over and beyond those great traits. So you ask a good question, why would this be? And I think there are a bunch of reasons. I think one is that dinner time is the most reliable time that families in 21st century America have to really pay attention to each other, look at each other in the eye, ask about how our days were and what you think about the world events or what's going on in the neighborhood, to decompress, to have a good time, to laugh a little bit. You know, it's not like we farm together anymore or knit quilts on the porch anymore. Dinner is really the most predictable time. In fact, teens will say and have in surveys that this is the time they're most likely to talk to their parents. So if you think of it as the sort of prime connecting time, then I think a lot of these benefits make sense, because when kids feel connected to their parents, it's like a seatbelt on a rocky road of adolescence and childhood.
Do the parents get any benefit out of it, or this is just about them sacrificing to make sure their kids are healthy?
You know, it's funny you should ask that, because I sort of had that view for the first 20 years that I've been thinking about this, thinking, well, this is a very generous thing that parents can do for their kids, and it's, you know, it can be tedious night after night to come up with dinner, and sometimes kids don't like it and they bellyache, and then there's the cleaning up and all of that. But then I looked into the research on this, and it turns out that actually family meals are good for adults too. They're good for them physically. They tend to eat more fruits and vegetables when they eat with their kids. They tend to engage in fewer destructive eating behaviors like binging and dieting, maybe because they know their kids are watching and they don't want to imitate that for their kids. And then their mental health benefits, too, even for, I mean, equally for mothers and fathers, even though we know mothers do the lion's share of meal preparation, even in 2021. But shared mealtime is associated with fewer depressive symptoms in both mothers and fathers, better self-esteem, better mood. And I think it's because it's a time to step away from your to-dos and your Zoom calls and all of that and decompress and have a ritual that is fairly predictable. You know where you're going to sit. You know that everybody is going to have something to say about their day. And I think adults really benefit from having rituals just like kids. You know, it gives some anchor to the day. It gives some stability.
So what's one of the recommendations that the Family Dinner Project makes for the food conundrum? If you've got a picky eater or...
Yes. So if you've got a picky eater and you don't want to be a short order chef and make four different dishes for four different kids, you might, or four different family members, you might make one central dish like a chicken rice soup that can then be customized with each, so each member can add what they like to jazz it up a little bit, or they can have it totally plain. You could use the same approach with pizza or lasagna or crepes. So you're making just one dish with some add-ons. You might take Ellen Satter, the nutritionist's advice. She says parents should decide what, where, and when, and kids decide how much. And I think what she's really getting at there is that it's up to the parents to produce something each night that they're pretty sure their kids will like because they've made it before. Maybe they've had a family meeting and they've come up with a list of acceptable dinner items and they've posted it on the refrigerator for everybody to see. And they make the dinner and then no discussion about it. Like the less said about the food, the better. So no cajoling. Like if you eat three more bites of your peas, you can have dessert.
And then it's a constant nagging. Have you eaten your three? Is this enough, Mom? You know, all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. So better just to put your best foot forward with a food you think everybody is going to like and then turn the conversation to other subjects.
And describe for us then, finally, one of your tips for making sure that that conversation happens, that it doesn't turn into nagging, and that your kids will say something more than one word.
So we have dozens and dozens of games on the website that are non-competitive and that are really designed to get conversation going. So I'll give you one example. It's called 20 Questions About a Memory. And each person at the table thinks of a memory. It could be yesterday or it could be 20 years ago. And then everybody else tries to guess the memory by asking yes or no questions.
Mm.
Did this happen when we were at a holiday? When we were younger than 10? Was anybody crying? And so on. Mm. And, you know, a memory gets guessed, and then whoever guesses it, it's their turn.
That's Anne Fischel, a family therapist, clinical professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, co-founder of the Family Dinner Project. The website for the tips she was referring to is thefamilydinnerproject.org. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Riemond produced the show. Find us online at byuradio.org/topofmind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.